This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the wee hours this morning, the Republican health reform plan cleared its first hurdle, the House Ways and Means Committee. This afternoon, it cleared hurdle number two, the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Both were party line votes. House Speaker Paul Ryan says he now wants to push the bill through the full House in just a couple of weeks, which means that fairly soon, Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch will get to cast his vote. And he joins us now. Congressman Stephen Lynch, welcome back to the show.
Good to join you, Meghna.
It's great to have you. So when the GOP health plan does land in the House, how are you going to vote?
Oh, I'll oppose it. This has been sort of a fire drill process here. There have been more, tax cuts for select industries than there have been really debates about the quality of health care in the bill. And what might happen to Medicare and Medicaid. And so it looks as though it would damage both of those programs. And so, you know, clearly it's not going in the direction that we had hoped, where, you know, there might be some improvements. This is really a slash and burn attempt. As you mentioned at the outset, they did this in a 27-hour session without hearings, markup. So I've never seen anything operated like this. This has really been, like I say, sort of a fire drill. There's been no open debate. There's been no serious consideration of amendments. And
Democrats said they were going to try and offer some 100 amendments, but apparently, you know, that none of those made it their way into the bill, which is going to go before the full House eventually. Congressman Lynch, let me just step back here for a second, because as some folks might remember, you actually voted against the Affordable Care Act.
I did.
Now known as Obamacare, back in 2010, because you had certain concerns about it, that there was no public option, and that there was that so-called Cadillac tax on expensive or high cost plans, amongst other reasons. Is there nothing in the new GOP reform plan, nothing at all that you see moves that could potentially move healthcare forward? Is it a complete no for you?
Well, they do maintain the requirement that insurance companies can't deny you coverage for pre-existing conditions. They've kept that aspect of it, and also I believe dependent children can still stay on a parent's plan until age 26.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two good things, but there's still, you know, this is the extreme in the other direction, where there's no support for you know, people who are, I would say, the middle-income group that is, remember, the stress is being caused because of rising prices.
Right.
Rising costs, and that doesn't seem to be alleviated at all here.
Yeah. So let me ask you, there's this notion, we're seeing reports that, for example, that President Trump has said that, say, this new GOP plan doesn't clear the House or doesn't clear the Senate, that he's considering letting so-called Obamacare, in his words, you know, quote unquote, fail, so that the Democrats ultimately take the blame for no long-term change or long-term improvement in the American health insurance system. I mean, is that a concern for you?
I don't think that will sell. We've been prevented from. I think that President Obama and other Democrats realized that there were a lot of fixes necessary for the Affordable Care Act to succeed and to become sustainable. However, none of those efforts were undertaken by the Republican Congress, and so that effort never came around.
Mm-hmm.
In the first version of the Affordable Care Act, we did not have a tax on health care benefits. We did have the state option for a public option, a state-by-state opportunity for public options. That was taken out. We also prevented monopoly and cartels being created by enforcing the antitrust laws against insurance companies.
Right.
That was taken out. So none of those things has been changed in a favorable way in this new iteration of the, you know, repeal and replace bill.
Well, so that makes me wonder, Congressman. You know, now that there's this renewed legislative focus on some kind of health reform, this time it's coming from the GOP. I mean, we obviously don't know what's going to happen yet when it goes to a House vote and then maybe on to the Senate. But in the possibility that the GOP plan doesn't make it to President Trump's desk, is this a time for maybe for Democrats to push for or put forth a bill that that calls for all those things that you just mentioned that weren't in the Affordable Care Act back in you know in the mid 2000s?
I suppose, yeah, theoretically you could. You know,
would you be interested in doing that?
Of course, but I don't think we would get the votes. You know, but we could certainly offer that. Yeah. As a matter of fact, that version of the Affordable Care Act had over 300 members vote for it in the House. And then, of course, Scott Brown got elected. They couldn't get it through the Senate, and so we had to settle with this other version that was far less favorable and really not coherent. That's the deal we have now.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, of course. Yeah. I'd be happy to proffer that bill and support it, but I'm not sure I could actually tell people that it have a realistic chance of passing.
Right. Well, let's move on and talk about a couple other issues that have to do with the U.S. military. Because as folks might recall, one of the first executive actions that President Trump took when he took office was issuing a memorandum that was calling for a hiring freeze on the entire federal government. But his chief of staff at the time repeated that the memorandum underscored that the memorandum did not apply to the U.S. military. Now, you and 23 House colleagues just signed a letter yesterday reminding the president of his promise to deliver for veterans in the same way that they say they're delivering for the nation. So what is your letter asking the president to do specifically?
Well, actually, I have a bill. It's H.R. 1001. I have over 120 co-sponsors. So the president put in a hiring freeze across the federal government. But I don't think he realized, or maybe he did, that we have 632,000 veterans who work for the federal government. It's 30% of our workforce in the federal government. So by putting this freeze in place, he denies all of those veterans who would normally be hired across our agencies at the VA, State Department, Defense Department, you know, National Park Service, TSA. We hire a lot of veterans. It prevents them from going to work. So over the past, I would say, month, I've had numerous veterans looking for jobs in the federal government. I've sat down with a few of them, and I've had to explain to them that the positions that they're applying for is subject to the freeze, and then they can't go to work. So while we have these young men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and other places in the military service, and we have elevated instances of suicide, we have elevated rates of homelessness and drug abuse, we're now putting up another barrier to their transition back to civilian life by saying, no, you can't go to work for the single largest employer of veterans in this country. And that's problematic. So my bill, H.R. 1001, would simply exempt veterans from the hiring freeze. So, for instance, I have 9,000 open requisitions over at the VA.
Yeah.
And if a veteran applied for that and was qualified, and I've had radiologists come into my office who, you know, obviously got their skills and training through the military, looking for jobs that they are eminently qualified for. So if my bill passed, they would be able to go to work. The bill would still apply, the freeze would still apply to the 70% of non-veterans that typically fill those positions.
Right, so it would just focus on not having the freeze for military veterans. Point
right.
Taken. So let me just switch to another story here that has connections to the military. You know where I'm going with this. This is the annual St. Patrick's Day parade in South Boston. For the past couple of years, an LGBTQ veterans group, OutVets, has been allowed to march in the parade. But, of course, in years past, they weren't. This year, the group that organizes the parade is once again telling out vets that they're not welcome and they're not going to be allowed to march. Congressman, this is your district. Is there anything you feel like you can do about this?
Well, sure. And actually, I'm in Washington right now, but it's my intention to resolve this in a way that allows out vets to march once again. As you mentioned, they've marched for the last couple of years. And one of the years, I think it was 2 years ago, they marched right behind me, and they received a very warm and respectful welcome from the community. There were no problems. I talked to all of the marchers at the end of the parade where we sort of began to disperse. They were beaming with they were very, very happy with the response they got from the community, and as a result, they came back the next year. Mm. So I just, so this is very surprising as well as troubling. We thought we had this resolved, and there's been no adverse consequences to any of this in the last couple of years. It's sort of, it hasn't been an issue.
Yeah.
But apparently this small group of individuals have influenced the Allied War Veterans Council to vote no, at least initially. I understand they've called for an emergency meeting. Myself, Mayor Walsh, Governor Baker, all the city councilors from the district at large and district, as well as the state representative, Nick Collins, and Senator Linda DeSinofori, have all said either this changes or we will not march.
Yeah, but on the other hand, Congressman, if I can ask, I mean, as you well know, this issue went to the United States Supreme Court, and the court actually ruled that the Allied Council actually has a right to exclude participants based on their right to free speech. I mean, so they're not in violation of any laws by making this decision.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. That was a case where, these are gay veterans. So you're letting all these other veterans march and you're excluding this other group. So I don't know if there's a legal distinction there, but there's certainly a societal one.
Right.
I think that the overwhelming 99.9999% of the people there are saying, this is part of our parade. It's not a problem. These veterans have served the country. They deserve the right to march. We welcome them. And I just had John Afuso here from HRC, the Human Rights Campaign. He's one of the marchers from previous years. And we're trying to work with the Allied War Veterans to make sure that he and the OutVets group has an opportunity to march.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that that comes to a mutually agreeable conclusion. I've just got a minute left with you, Congressman, and I really, really want to ask you one last thing, because, as you know, you're facing a challenger in the Democratic primary in your district, and that challenge is coming from businesswoman and game developer Brianna Wu. We actually talked with her on the show a couple of weeks ago, and here's what she said about why she's running against you as a Democrat.
I personally don't consider him a Democrat. I look at his background on voting for reproductive health care. I look at some of the bills he tried to pass about LGBT rights. And, I personally think Massachusetts can do so much better.
Congressman, do you think that you have that you have sort of weakness on your left flank here, that there's room for a progressive challenger or someone who calls herself a progressive challenger like Brianna Wu to you?
I mean, really, I got sworn in 4 weeks ago. I got sworn in last month. I'm not going to start campaigning now.
Congressman, the terms are 2 years long in this day and age. I can't help it if the election season is never ending.
It does end for me. It'll start. So we have a process in Massachusetts where you get the signatures and you become a candidate. And look, I'm sure I'll have many candidates that'll be running against me, probably four or five. I had a couple last 2 years ago, and that happens. But in between elections, I have to do some work. And so I think it's a bit much. You know, 5 weeks after I get sworn in on a 2-year term, that I have to begin campaigning again, and we're going to start doing shows about, you know, people who are running or not running. I really have to do my job. I took an oath. I owe this to the people that I represent. There is a cycle here. It's a 2-year cycle. It's very, very brief.
Yeah.
Very brief. So the opportunity you have to just focus on your job is very limited.
Congressman,
and there'll be plenty of time to do a campaign and debates and all that stuff. But it's just not now.
Congressman,
and
everybody has the right to run.
God bless them.
I just want to jump in here and say that I take your point. And again, personally, as a citizen, do I love that the campaigns seem never ending? No. But speaking of doing our jobs, I'm just doing my job, my due diligence here.
Because
we had to ask you about that.
I know that.
Spent 20 minutes talking about other policies.
Yeah. No, thank you.
All right.
Thank
you. Well, look forward to having you back. Congressman Stephen Lynch represents Massachusetts 8th. Thanks as always.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.